Hello, everybody. It's Gareth. This is the Somewhere on Earth podcast. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of April, 2024. And a big hello to you from our studio here in London. All right, joining us today again, she was with us last week as well, Angelica Murray. Two weeks on the trot. How about that? I'm getting used to this now. And I think this is lovely. How are you, Angelica?
Yeah, I'm happy to be back.
Good stuff. Because you've been, as always, out and about covering things. And you've been to an especially interesting summit, haven't you, recently?
Yeah, I just returned from South Summit, Brazil. It took place in Porto Alegre, the capital of Rio Grande do Sul. It's a state in the extreme south of Brazil. It's very close to Uruguay and Argentina. So it's a Brazilian version of a Madrid event in its third edition. And Brazil is a continent, right? And every state right now wants to develop their own tech market. And the state of Rio Grande do Sul is trying to evolve what they already have. So when it comes to events, I've been to a few of these recently, and I think they can be a bit samey in terms of content, Gareth.
What, so you pick up your lanyard, you get your swag bag.
Yeah.
There's and that also awkward hanging around on the first day.
What they discuss is, you know, how AI is going to take over the world and all of our jobs and all that. But blah, blah. I think the main attraction here, beyond the local context, of course, is networking. So I've been thinking about the role of these large events as a way to sort of sophisticate regional tech environments, and also how fast they manage to do that. And the conclusion here, Gareth, is that it all depends on the amount of influential people from traditional companies involved and how much money is invested as well. So,
So the legacy companies and money, entrepreneurs in it for the long haul. I just wonder if that might become a theme today.
Yeah.
That's beautifully teased. My goodness. Looking forward to that. Let's jump in. Coming up in this edition, we have a tech visionary for you. Yes, another one. It was Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales the other day. But today, I'm talking to the woman who kind of invented IT outsourcing, having set up a small programming company in the 1960s that grew into a giant that created a whole bunch of millionaires, most of them women, when it sold off in the 1990s. Not bad for someone who started out in life as a child refugee fleeing the Nazis in the 1930s. Also today, a supercomputer in Brazil. So just how super is this computer? That's all right here on the Somewhere on Earth podcast. Well, first then, few tech or business stories are more remarkable than that of Dame Stephanie Steve Shirley. Oh, and that name Steve, by the way, it comes into things because as Stephanie built up her first businesses in the 60s and 70s, more people replied to her letters when they were signed Steve than when they were signed Stephanie. Anyway, now, age 90, Dame Shirley's life, well, it really has been astonishing. She created one of the UK's first IT outsourcing companies in 1962, selling it for millions when it finally floated in 1996. Born in 1933, Stephanie moved from Germany to Britain as a kinder transport child refugee. She went on to work for a while at the post office's Dollis Hill Research Centre and then went on to have a stellar business career and as a philanthropist. Dame Stephanie is also the author of the book Let It Go, My Extraordinary Story. And what an extraordinary story it is. Well, I caught up with Dame Shirley the other day, just after she'd spoken at Tech Show London. She told me that her main message to the delegates was that in business, we should all get better at, well, taking our time.
I think many people think in terms of projects that are weeks and months, whereas the really strategic ones actually take years. And what I talked about was the 17 years it took to make my first charity freestanding, managerially and financially independent of me, the 25 years before we paid our first dividend, and it was puny dividend compared with Microsoft. Even the mighty Microsoft took 10 years to pay its dividend. These things are long term, and today's entrepreneurs are very used to getting capital in very early. I didn't have that, and so my progress, I suppose, was very slow and steady before we actually reached any sensible size.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that. This was Freelance Programmers, wasn't it?
That's right.
Really one of the first UK tech startups, wasn't it? When did it start?
We started in 1962, the 10th of August. I shall never forget it. We celebrated 60 years, even though the company no longer exists. It's been taken over, but we celebrated 60 years and lost 88 people turned up or something, still from the early days.
Which is lovely. I mean, because this was, I mean, in itself an incredible story and worth just bringing the listeners up to speed with. All about women working from home, wasn't it? In technology, doing coding, doing projects, you know, outsourcing effectively, or taking outsourced work from companies.
It really was a social business. I didn't go into business to make money, though eventually, of course, I made serious money. But I went into business to provide work opportunities for women with children, people who'd left the industry on marriage or when their first child was expected, and wanted to come back, wanted to be active in the industry, but didn't want to go back into an office. So it was a very family-friendly way of working, very flexible to the extreme. You could work part-time, you could work home-based, you could work summertime only, you could work term time only. We really flexed the arrangements. I think we did one of the very first job shares, for example, just because we're prepared to consider any way of getting work done.
And people around at the time may have, especially the more forward-looking ones, may have said, well, this is the way of the future now. Surely by about the mid-70s, a lot of people will be working from home and doing this kind of work in a very flexible way. But it kind of took until the 2010s for anybody really to be doing that seriously, didn't it?
It's taken a long time for it to become fashionable.
Why do you think that is, especially if you proved it as a business model, as a working model so early on?
I think people assumed that the success of my company was due to the technology, and it wasn't. It was due to a management style, a business style, and so it will transfer into other arenas.
It was women only to start with, but that did have to change, didn't it?
Well, in 1975, I mean, 13 years from startup, equal opportunities legislation came in Britain, and so what we were doing to do positive discrimination for women was actually illegal. So we had to welcome the men in, and thereafter it gradually became well balanced between the sexes.
Yes, indeed. Or as I think one person put it at the time, well, we let the men in at the end. But you welcomed them too, of course. Very welcoming.
I've learned
company
to
culture.
Say that.
Absolutely. I don't know if this is just apocryphal, but is it true that you or some of your fellow colleagues had to have typewriter sound effects playing in the background to cover up maybe the sound of all the domestic hubbub in the household in order for clients to take you seriously? Is that just one of those myths, or did that happen?
No, it didn't have to happen, but certainly I had a tape recorder playing office noises in the background, so that it sounded as if I had office noises in the background, so that it sounded as if I was in a busy office. Everybody typing, hard typing in those days, of course. Very, very fast.
Wow. So that story is true, or at least the way you put it. I probably didn't summarise it particularly well. But the business did float in the end, didn't it, in 1996? And you created a whole load of female millionaires, didn't you?
I think 70. 70. Oh.
Gosh.
And I'm very proud of that. And it's all part of sharing. We always worked in teams. I think it's quite a feminine characteristic. We were not really competitive with each other. We really helped each other, perhaps because we felt we had to. And that developed into a very collegiate culture, so that when we had a success, I wanted it to be shared by everybody who'd contributed. And to a sense, everybody contributed, including the girls on the switchboard. So we went for co-ownership, and I'm very proud to have got 24% of the company's shares into the hands of the staff at no cost to anyone but me. And by a complicated system of double voting, 62% control of the company was in the hands of the staff. It took 11 years to make that happen. So these things are never easy.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AI is changing the game of business. Will you be on the winning team? I'm Jordan Wilson, the host of the Everyday AI podcast and your coach to help you learn the X's and O's of AI. Artificial intelligence isn't just a new player in the game, it's a new sport altogether. So if you don't quickly put AI into play, your competitors will run up the score. I've spent my whole life building winning teams, from coaching basketball to working with big players like Nike and Jordan Brand. My next move? Helping you win with Everyday AI. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or on everydayaipodcast.com. Let's tap into AI together and put points on the board.
So at the Tech Show London, you've been talking about the business lessons you've learned from that example, and then the many other organizations, both for profit and not for profit, that you've gone on to be a part of since. So one of the messages is to kind of take your time and to understand that it takes a while to build a business. It can take a decade before you even get a dividend, often longer. Do you get a lot of pushback on that when there's so much emphasis now on piling in a whole load of venture capital so companies can have a lot of money, but they're not actually making money? Is yours quite a difficult message to get across, do you think, in the tech culture, and dare I say the tech bro culture that we're in at the moment?
I think things have moved on. I don't think a company like Freelance Programmers would survive in today's environment. What you do always has to be appropriate for the time and the place that you're doing it, and with your own skills. I mean, I wasn't capable of running a corporate when I started. You gradually have to learn on the job.
So learning on the job, and I suppose understanding that things take time. Because I know that one of your messages at the tech show has been about being prepared to be in it for the long term, or at the very least, the businesses that really go on to survive are the ones, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, are the ones that maybe grew from the outset with an idea of the long term, the idea that it's a marathon, not a sprint, or maybe a marathon and a sprint. Having that mindset is more likely to give business success. Could I summarize it in that way?
I think that's fine. I mean, the quick fixes seldom work.
Why not?
Because they're ill thought out, they're done in a hurry, they're not done quality, they're not planned, they're not experimented with, they're not trialled properly, they just rush ahead.
So we're recording this interview, as it happens, on Friday the 8th of March. It's going out on the podcast a bit later. But as we sit here recording this now, it is International Women's Day. And yours is an incredible story to tell in terms of bringing more women and girls into technology. We've talked about freelance programmers. But when did it first occur to you then that there was this difference between how boys and girls were treated in the business world and, of course, even before that, through their education?
I think it was probably when I was at school, and girls, they were all unisex schools in those days, and girls' schools didn't teach science. The only science thought respectable for girls was botany. So I had to really fight to get tuition in mathematics, which is what was my passion. And I finished up actually attending the boys' school, again unisex, which was a salutary introduction to the sexism of the workplace. You know, I was helped by the powers that be to get my tuition, and it's made an enormous impact on my life, because of course it led to computers, and computers have made my life, really, apart from the charitable work.
And of course, famously, you have changed your name, or at least you go by the name Steve. And You did that then in order for people to take you, in inverted commas, seriously, didn't you? Was it a suggestion of your husband's that you go by a man's name, not a woman's name?
I was working in a very simple way. I was sending out letters to people who were advertising in the media for programmers. And my letters were pretty standard letters saying, I'm not applying for your programming job, but I can offer you programming services. And at that time, software was given away free with the hardware. So people thought that was a bit extreme. I've got this double feminine name, Stephanie Shirley, Shirley being my marital name, and happened to be also a girl's name in the UK. So Stephanie Shirley got absolutely no response to her letters at all. And it was my dear, late husband who suggested that I use the family nickname of Steve. So I wrote the same sort of letters to the same sorts of prospects, signing them Steve Shirley. And that apparently made a difference because people started to reply and I started to get some meetings and I started to get some work.
I suppose whatever works. Very sad that you had to do that. I mean, do you think that should be a strategy now, possibly? I'm being deliberately provocative here, but, you know, let's just get down to it.
You would hope it wouldn't be necessary at all, but I do notice the number of women who use androgynous names, Leslie, Joe, J.K. Rowling, the author, for example, didn't use her own name because she didn't think she'd be able to get published.
Yeah, it's still pretty shocking, even in this day and age. What would your advice be then, based on your many experiences, to, well, let's split this into two parts. Partly into younger people, like girls maybe going through school, choosing STEM subjects over others. And then, of course, later in one's career as a woman, going through business, going through technology and succeeding.
My advice to young women is exactly the same as the advice I'd give to young men. To find an area in which you're really interested, which you find fascinating, which you can get enthusiastic about, and then really do some research and get trained in that area, and then get retrained so that you're at the leading edge, and then forgetting what everybody else tells you, just go ahead and do it and make it happen. Take a risk and make it happen.
That's Dame Stephanie Shirley, and there's more from her in the podcast edition of this podcast. So if you want to subscribe, then it's pretty easy to do. Often, depending on your podcatcher, you might see a little kind of padlock logo. Just click on that and work it out, and you'll be able to be one of the marvelous people who subscribes to us for just $10 US a month, and in return you get some podcast extra content and you get an awful lot of love from us because you're keeping the lights on around here. Okay, now Angelica, you were sitting listening to that interview with me, weren't you? Had you thinking a little bit about different ways of working, business models, working models and so on, didn't it?
Yeah, at first, it is an absolute delight to hear Dame Shirley, isn't it? Such a role model. When I interviewed her back when I was a rookie, I was in awe because she's such a visionary. And I think particularly regarding working models, she was truly ahead of her time, wasn't she, when she started her company? And she proved that building a solid company has nothing to do with whether you're sitting from a desk at the office or not. It has to do with culture, right? You see that nearly 100 people turned up to celebrate the anniversary of a company that not even exists anymore with her. So that kind of illustrates the kind of environment that her company was, the appreciation that management had for people's circumstances, their needs, what they actually wanted, which in many cases was working remotely. And that point about making people happy, something you wonder when you see companies reverting to office-based work. And I think businesses have to consider people's satisfaction at work as much more than just salary. I think remote work really enables folks to adjust work to their life circumstances. And I understand there is value in face-to-face interaction, I like a bit of water cooler conversation, but it is quite concerning that so many companies are trying to force people to work from the office all the time. It's like winding a clock back, don't you think, Gareth?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's just about getting the balance right. And I think another thing is it just depends on the business. I think having a blanket rule like, hey, everyone, every business should do 2 days in the office a week, 3 days remotely. Of course, it depends on the sector. It depends on the business. Maybe it even depends on your seniority in the company. There are lots of different factors at play. But I think just calling people into the office for the sake of it, and even worse, if maybe the director's thinking, well, I just like to see people here. It just maybe makes me feel important to see
just
all these people sitting
shoulder,
at their desks.
Right?
Yeah, that presenteeism, it does make me wonder.
It's really strange. Companies that proven to themselves that they could make it work during the pandemic, just trying to reverse things. It is really strange.
Yeah, I think the trouble with the place I work is they put people in offices who get on well with each other, because I have two office mates and we all get on so well. And to be honest, I never get any work done in the office because I'm the guilty one. I'm just chatting all the time and I do have to just say, oh, shall we just do some work? And the other two are probably thinking, Gareth, can we just a bit of quiet time, please? So anyway, sorry, folks, if I do that too much.
So you have to work at home and make your own cups of tea.
Yeah, the indignity of it. The other thing that came out from that interview with Dame Shirley was about this whole being in it for the long run as well. And her message to startups, just come on, take your time. The gratification is not always instant and it shouldn't be. Did that resonate with you?
Well, I've been a freelance journalist for many years, as you know, and the listeners might know, which is kind of being an entrepreneur on your own. But today I also run a research business focused on futures with two other people. And I can relate with what Dame Shirley said about building a business for the long run, bootstrapping, finding ways to do things with limited resources and all that. But I think the point about wanting things too quickly can be about growing really and showing the world what you're made of as soon as possible. But it can also be growth in order to divest, to sell your company as soon as possible too and move on. But I think, Gareth, that very often that ability to achieve things quickly is conditional to having the capital needed to scale. And let's remember, female founders only get like 2% of all venture capital invested in companies led by women.
And only but is that still the case?
2%.
Wow. 2%. And, that's rubbish.
And 3% of funds are led by women. So wanting to succeed quickly may or may not be a good thing, but achieving that today is not a reality for most women leading a business.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Those statistics, astonishing. You might have hoped things had changed a bit. Clearly not.
They actually are getting worse. It was actually close to 4%. And recently it has decreased by 2% or so. Yeah. So not really a uplifting scenario.
I'm afraid not. Angelica, while we're chatting then, and the subject change here, there's no easy sort of transitional segue here. You can hear the gears crunching in the somewhere on Earth gearbox here. Let's talk about supercomputers. And this is people who maybe are frequent flyers to this podcast and who perhaps remember our previous incarnation as Digital Planet may remember that in the Digital Planet days, you spoke to the head of this agency, wasn't it? A space agency in Brazil, about this astonishing supercomputer for predicting the weather. And that story was quite initial. It was quite early days. And I probably said something like, hey, well, we'll keep an eye on this one and we'll report on it at some other time. So here we are reporting on it some other time, having kept an eye on this story.
Yeah.
So what's the latest?
So, yeah, when we spoke to the director for the National Institute for Space Research in São Paulo, It is an organization, by the way, that is linked to the Ministry of Science and Technology and Innovations in Brazil. So they finally received funding for a new supercomputer that will enhance climate forecasting capabilities in Brazil. So the background for this, Gareth, is that things are not very uplifting either for in terms of climate change in Brazil. We've recorded over 1,000 disasters linked to extreme weather events in 2023. So that's more than 3 a day, and that's a record high. So there were floods and landslides, and the Amazon region has suffered with historic drought. So unfortunately, several hundreds of people have died and the cities have suffered significant financial loss. So this supercomputer, the promise is that scientists will be able to predict the weather, understand space, and also do businessy things like calculating risks and for that insurance companies needed a lot in the scenario of climate change. So their new machine will have processing power equal to 8 petaflops. So sometimes, Gareth, you know that journalists ask for things to be explained very simply. So the explainer I got for what 8 petaflops is like is something like this. Imagine you have a super fast calculator that can do 8 billion math problems in just 1 second. That's what 8 petaflops is like. It's like as if you could count to 8 followed by 15 zeros faster than you could blink. So yeah, this project will cost 200 million reais in total, and it will be made in stages, this investment, starting in 2024 and is expected to conclude by 2027. So the cherry on the cake of this project, beyond the actual machinery, according to the Space Research Agency, is a new numerical weather and climate forecasting model called MONAN. So that's the model for forecasting the oceans, land surfaces, and the atmosphere. And that's still under development. So that is special because in addition to traditional methods based on solving physical equations, this MONAN model, we use artificial intelligence and machine learning to predict the beginning and the end of severe rainfall and also extreme weather events like 3 days in advance. And forecast also climate change trends and 3 months in advance. So currently forecasting is really a strange thing, isn't it, Gareth? You hear on the television that it's going to rain and then you have to be carrying your umbrella for 3 days. And that's because forecasting is limited to a 15-day range and accuracy is high only in the first 48 hours, and it falls below 50% after 7 days. I've interviewed Clésio Nardin, the director at the National Institute for Space Research, to find out what will change in terms of Brazil's ability to deal with extreme weather events and how MONAN could be a game changer.
O novo sistema de supercomputação do INPE irá permitir o desenvolvimento e a implementação do modelo comunitário do Sistema Terrestre Unificado, o MONAN. Esse é modelo que tem...
INPE's new supercomputer system will enable the development and implementation of the Unified Earth System Community Model, MONAN. It's a meteorological model and an environmental model that includes several gases that have not been modeled before. The model can cover the whole planet or just a region through an adaptive mesh. MONAN has several advantages over current models, and it can run on the new supercomputer that's been built here.
According to Clésio, another important characteristic of MONAN is the fact that it's a community-based model, and there is a national scientific committee that was set up around it. And there are Latin American and European groups focused on numerical modeling for the validation of the agency's scientific advancements. But that openness also has to do with technology.
Ele é não comunitário pelo simples fato de ter sido desenvolvido por essa comunidade, porque ele é de código aberto. Ele pode ser.
It is not a community-based project just because of the fact that it was developed by a scientific community, but it is an open source initiative. It can be continually developed and can be used by everyone who wants to use it. It can be tested by universities, and the great advantage is that it is licensed in such a way that anyone can use it. You just can't sell it. And that represents a major effective advancement in terms of quality, reliability, and predictability of meteorological events, especially extreme events such as heat waves.
I also wanted to find out how other governments around the world might be able to use Monan for more precise forecasting of extreme weather events.
Eu não estou nem falando, né, que com sistemas como esse, sendo código aberto, os países poderão alcançar o estado da arte, a previsão da atmosfera, oceanos, e poderão produzir aplicações de state-of-the-art
forecasting model for the atmosphere and oceans. This will allow them to produce applications and technologies with massive socioeconomic impact in their regions, giving rise to a new generation of numerical weather, climate and environmental products on a timescale that is relevant to society. Countries that rely on numerical weather forecasting carried out in Brazil can move forward, because now they will have open source codes to be able to develop their own regional models and include their own data. Look at the advances we are promoting in the country with this new supercomputer. The integration of the supercomputer with the Monan model will bring a lot of benefits to society.
So, Clésio Nardin there, director at the National Institute for Space Research, talking to you there, Angelica Mowry, and lovely factoid around this whole supercomputer. It'll be the world's first ever supercomputer to be powered by solar. Wow.
Yeah,
that's
right.
There's an achievement, and appropriate given its role in forecasting weather as well, and climate events and all that. Angelica, thank you. Just before we go, can we do a quick bit of suds, a quick bit of allocating subscriber numbers to our dear listener stroke subscribers?
Yeah, that's really important. We should
it
do
is
that.
Quite important. Let the listeners speak. So we'll just do these two, and then I've got a few lined up for the weeks to come. So Adrian Warren says, I'm hereby requesting my SOAP SUDS number. The number I'm requesting is 2782. And the reason is that it's in hex. I'm a nerd, says Adrian. And so in hex, that's A-D-E, Aid, which of course is Adrian's nickname. He's ever so clever. And he did this request apparently as his digital planet listener number, but alas, never got a response at the time. So Adrian's hoping for better luck this time. Well, can we grant Adrian that we need a yes, at least two other yeses? I'm getting a thumbs up from Anya behind the glass. And what do you reckon, Angelica? Casting vote?
Yeah, I agree to it. Yeah. It's
brilliant.
Aid should have his number.
Aid, there's your number. Put it on your LinkedIn profile. Some listeners do, really. And
awesome.
And just
can I claim one as well?
Oh, good. I wasn't expecting that to happen. Yeah, I think so. I mean, Anya and I would have to approve it. I think we need at least three approvals. So, because I would also have to approve as well. So
I'll give it some thought. I'll have a chat with Aid to find a good hex.
Okay. Oh, so you're not requesting something now. All right. But when you do, we'll hastily convene the committee and make that happen for you. And Martin from Mozambique of goat fame says, amazing to hear how different we sound on playback as opposed to the way we think we sound, says Martin, having heard a recording of his voice, of his very nice voice, I should say. And Martin says, my request is for listener number 17, if it's still available, for no no other reason than I really do love a nice round number. Now, just before I put that to the committee, really quickly, I'm just checking on the database here. No, 17 is still available. So can Martin have 17? Thumbs up from Anya. And how about you, Angelica?
I love that number. It's the day I got married. So, yes, aww, you can have that number.
Lovely. So we've got a beautiful human story behind that as well. Martin, you did well with that one. You got 17. Good number. Heaven 17, good band. Martin Ware, oh, lovely. Right, there we are. That'll do for this week. We'll carry on. We'll do some subscriber extra for you. But if you're saying goodbye for now, then see you next week. From all of us here on the team at Lanson's Team Fana, it's been lovely to have you. So Keziah doing the audio, Anya doing the production, Angelica doing a lot of the talking, me, Gareth, doing even more of the talking, and Liz, who's the grown-up in the room who just manages the production, which is incredibly important. Thanks for listening. See you soon. Bye.